podcast uses profanity and topics may be disturbing for some listeners. Listen at your own risk. Welcome to Hell on Hills Podcast. I'm Bryce.
I'm Amanda.
And hello, welcome back.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm not bad. Not bad at all.
That's good to hear. You still have a car? Hold on. Guys, Amanda started laughing and her face is covered.
Funny you should say that. My car is a death trap. Like, I'm gonna have... How does one cleanse a vehicle of negative energy?
I assume sage. Maybe
I don't have sage. I have, what's the stick? The wood? Holy wood?
Sure.
I don't think that's a thing.
I don't know. You have a stick? Don't beat up your car.
It's only like this big.
It's don't like poke your
stick
car.
That you burn.
A smudge stick?
No, not a smudge stick. Because a smudge stick is still sage, right?
I have no clue.
I don't either. People that know what... Somebody tell me what I'm talking about. Oh shit, that was it.
Do we need to Google stick to cleanse bad spirits? Hold on.
I already Googled it. Okay, what is this? Palo Santo? Yeah, Palo Santo. Palo Santo. I don't know if I'm saying that right.
Okay. I haven't heard of it.
It's a Palo Santo stick. Oh. No, it won't. It says it's used to clear out negative energy. It's also a traditional remedy for pain, inflammation, and stress. So I don't remember what I bought it for, but I bought it and I recently found it.
Maybe just get a smudge stick and, you know, do a little chant or something around your car. Because what happened?
Okay, so I'm driving home. And, okay, let's roll it back a little bit. So I started at corporate. This last week, Monday, I started at the corporate office and I like it. There's a ridiculous amount of downtime, mainly because this is wildly different from what I was doing. So there's a lot to learn and there's a lot of like, if you screw it up, some things, if you screw it up, you could potentially like really screw it up. But for the most part, it's pretty easy. It's easy yet convoluted, if that makes sense.
You just got to learn the industry standard or like the rules that you have to follow, basically.
Yes. And there's so much to it that I'm learning it a little bit at a time. So we're getting there. It's convoluted in the fact that like I have to use like three or four different programs and like multiple windows on Chrome at any given time. So it's just kind of like there's shit everywhere. I do have two screens, but I want three. Like that's kind of how much is going on.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I like it. I feel like I've picked up a lot. They all tell me I'm doing good, and I don't think they're lying. So, cool.
You're only one week in, right?
Yes, and I finished that week one training the second day. So, for the rest of the week, I was just kind of like, okay, they didn't put me on the phone system, so I'm just catching emails of the stuff that I can do. And if something comes in and I don't know how to do it, I'll, like, do it from my desk. But not like set anything in stone. And then I'll wait and I'll be like, hey, so and so, is this how you do this? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, cool, I'll do these from now on too.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, that's been going well. I sent you I know this is a crazy thing, like the pay is way better and all that too. But I sent you a picture of the snack machine, right?
Yeah, I think you meant to send that to James though.
I don't know what's been going on with my phone. I'll like, you know how you can click the bubbles, remember, before your iPhone, where you could click the chat bubbles?
Mm-hmm.
I have been clicking James's lately, and it texts you, and then it texts my dad. And I just start texting. I didn't realize until afterwards, and I was like, son of a bitch. But yes.
I'm just super afraid of what I'm gonna get. I'm like,
No, that's fine. That's fine. We have two kids. We're tame right now.
No, I'm more concerned that I'm gonna get something like, F this heifer, and F this, and F that. And it's going to be something about someone I don't know, but you meant to send it to James.
That wasn't James. That was my daycare.
Well, yes, but I'm waiting for the day that it's supposed, I'm waiting for the day it's about me. And you're like, she won't budge on the time, or what, I don't know what it is that I won't budge on, because I'm pretty flexible. But
yeah. I was going to say, well, it's not going to be that.
She's doing this. I don't know what I'm doing wrong. Whatever pisses you off. She's itching constantly while we're doing our recording, and it pissed me off.
Her enormous chin only allowed half of her chest to get sunburned.
And Cody confirmed it was her enormous chin causing the issue.
Sorry, guys. That happened right before we started recording. Bryce asked Cody, like, hey, is this a sunburn on my chest? And Cody came over and he's like, yep, that's a sunburn. It's an, oh, I think he said an agitated sunburn.
Yeah.
Specifically. Yeah. And Bryce said something about it only being on half her chest. And he was like, oh, that's because of the angle from your chin. The sun was shading it.
Your chin was shading it from the sun. And I said, thanks for calling my chin big. And then he walked away.
It's been fun.
Yeah. So anyways, guys, yeah, I have a sunburn. That was not the point of this story.
Oh, that's right. Sorry. crazy vending machine. It's like basically a store, and then you just scan, you grab what you want. It's got a refrigerated section on either side. It's got what you name it, candy, snacks, popcorn, sandwiches, Lunchables. And then you just scan it and then you pay with your card, or you can program your card into the machine and pay with your thumbprint so you don't have to bring your wallet. That I will not be doing because that feels real dangerous.
Risky.
I'm going to have so many Dr. Pepper Zeros, which they have, which is awesome. Haven't seen those anywhere, and I haven't looked, but it's cool. But yes, so that's going well. Fancy snack machine. On the way home, the second day. So we're going down the interstate. I'm in the fast lane. People are in the right lane. I'm in the left lane. Yeah, because not right. I'm in the left lane, and there's a car in front of me, and I'm not, like, two car lengths away, because there's also a really impatient car behind me. I'm not two car lengths away. I was probably, like, one and a half, maybe. No, it was farther away from one. I'd say probably one and a half car lengths away from the car in front of me. Well, the car in front of me, I don't know what happened. All I know is the car in front of me hit a tire. That was, I guess it probably popped from like a semi or something or whatever they do. Because it was just a long, it wasn't a full round tire. It was a long strip of tire. And the car in front of me ran it over, which flung it up in the air. And then it hit my car, which another reason to not be directly behind someone on the interstate, other than the fact that you can't stop in enough time. If I would have been any closer, it very easily could have hit my windshield. Because it basically, like, vertically hit my car. So the top of it slapped my hood and left a huge black scuffed up dent in it. And it also cracked my grill. I lost the emblem on the front of my car and it cracked my bumper.
Hey, question. Mm-hmm. Is this on the part of the interstate where you broke down the first and second time?
No, because I'm coming a different direction from work now.
Is it the same interstate?
Yes.
Have you thought that maybe it's not your car, but it's the interstate that's after you?
Well, see, here's the fun thing about Arkansas. I had to think about it. No, there's no way for me to get from here to work without taking the interstate.
No convenient way. I'm sure there's a way to do it.
Yeah. But there's, okay, yeah, good point. There's no, like, highways. Like, you're just like, oh, I'm going to get off the interstate and take the scenic route. No, it is scenic, but there's not just a direct highway or anything. So, that's not going to happen. But, I'm so tired of that car. I had a good thing going. I was in a good mood. I had it back. And now this happened. So I'm probably going to smudge it with something. You know what? I will roll the Palo Santo wood in sage and then burn it.
Maybe you just stick... Ooh, maybe you should try crystals.
Should, like, I put some in the car?
Yeah, put some crystals in the car.
Okay.
See how that goes for you?
It can't hurt.
Nothing can hurt, okay?
It can't hurt. And I was so upset because I was like, after all I've been through with my car, the one redeeming quality it had is that she looked pretty. And now it doesn't even have that.
That's a bummer, too.
Oh, I was so mad. So, yeah, now I have to, I think, next week. I'll probably just leave it with James, and on one of his off days, he's going to take it to the shop whenever they can get it in.
So you're about to not have your car again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, you had a good thing going for you for a minute.
For what? Like, not even a month?
No.
A couple weeks.
I said a minute.
Yeah. A couple weeks.
Oh.
Anyway, how have you been?
Well, I've got a story for you.
Okay.
That involves little Miss Grinch Paws over there.
Oh, okay.
I am calling her Grinch Paws because she ran in my house and her feet are stained green, guys, because Cody was mowing the lawn. So she's got Grinch Paws right now. But
it's great.
I don't know what I did to her. I have no idea what I did to upset her. But for the past like week and a half, she has wanted nothing to do with me. And I mean nothing. She comes in tonight.
You think it's because of the babies coming?
Oh, well, okay. I have a theory about, we have a couple theories, but like she's been coming in every night and giving Cody kisses goodnight, but doesn't even acknowledge me.
Oh.
Uh-huh. And then on like my off days or days where Cody's out of bed early, normally she'll come lay in Cody's spot with me and I can love on her and we can snuggle. Not been doing that. She's been refusing. And then normally when I get up to do my hourly potty break throughout the night, she wakes up and kind of follows and watches. Not been doing that. So
she's like, you are on your own.
She is livid with me. So I have a couple theories. First being that I've had a lot of doctor's appointments recently. And I kind of am wondering if she's getting butt hurt because she can't go to those.
Because you're leaving her at home. You're abandoning
her at home. She's being abandoned. It's horrible. I'm the worst. All of that. And then the other part of the theory, which they could play hand in hand, is that I've been insanely busy at work. Like, I think there was one night where I was like, there was no way I could record. This was a couple weeks ago. There was no way I could record because I had issues with a customer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The following week, I also had issues with a customer and a go live. And so I worked basically 8 to 8.
Ew.
And then
I'm mad.
The following week, this past week, I had another customer go live, but they don't close until 9 Eastern Standard Time. That's 7 o'clock my time. And so I think I'm not intentionally ignoring her. I'm just focused on work.
Yeah.
And she's been trying to get attention. And I've not been giving her the attention she wants. And so I think those two things are playing into it. And she's been real bitter.
So what you're telling me is you deserve it.
Yeah. I finally I was back in her good graces this morning. And then I went to Camille's football game. And I'm probably not in her good graces anymore because she couldn't go with.
What were you thinking?
Well, I wanted to go cheer Mill on for her last game.
So why can't she go with?
They don't allow dogs at the park during games.
Part of me wants to say lame, but also I understand.
Yeah, so it's fine. It's not a big deal. Like, sucks to be her. But also, I think that's part of it is she's just... So tomorrow, I'm going to my mom and dad's for... We're doing Cinco de Mayo.
We're doing that here, too.
We're actually technically doing Mother's Day, but it's on Cinco de Mayo, so might as well just call it, you know, Mother Both. Cinco de Mayo.
Yeah.
She can go with me to that one, so I'm hoping I earn my place back tomorrow. And then next week, I don't have any doctor's appointments, so I don't have to leave her at any point in time next week that I'm aware of.
It sounds like you've got your work cut out for you.
Oh, yeah. Let me just tell you, I've been feeding her so much string cheese, trying to get her love back. I'm like, please love me again.
And does it work?
No. But I might as well try, okay?
Yeah.
So. But yeah, she's been real, real upset with me. And I don't know why, but I'm trying to earn her love back.
You better try harder.
The big dogs still love me. It's just her. I don't know.
He knocked his bone off the couch and then scared himself.
That feels like a him problem.
Yeah, he's a special boy. It's my Uncle Daddy dog.
That's fine. Anyways, that's my story about how I effed up. And now Maisie's upset with me. So, anyways, that's it. That's all I got for you.
Well, if you want to tell us about some socials, I've got a story for you.
Yeah, we can talk about some socials. We've got them. We've got Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook and Instagram, Helen Hales Podcast. I did call it Twitter. I know it's X, but we like Twitter more.
Yeah.
X is Helen Hales Pod because they cut me off. And then we also have our Discord. If you want to get to Discord, you can find the link on Linktree, Instagram, Facebook, X, all the things. And then we also have our Patreon up and going. So if you want to join us on Patreon, we're working to release specials there. If you have any suggestions, questions, complaints, if you have complaints, go ahead and send them to us. We're just going to laugh at them. Yeah. But think about how many times I've laughed at my dad's complaints. Stop. But if you have any of those, you can email us hellonheelspodcast@gmail.com, all spelled out. And then if you guys do enjoy listening and enjoy our stories that we share, go ahead and tell your friends, family, frenemies, situationships, whoever, to listen as well. That way we can keep expanding and keep releasing these episodes. And I think that's everything.
Okay. Have you ever heard of Paul Dennis Reed Jr.?
Yes. I can't remember why, though.
Does the fast food killer ring a bell?
Vaguely, yes.
That's what he was known as. And before I start, I got a huge amount of info from two places, and the two places did vary just a teeny bit. So I saw this story on It Takes a Killer on Oxygen, and a lot of people that were involved in the case talked about it on there. And then the other source is a book. It's free on Audible right now. But Audible, no. Who? It's free on Kindle. If you have the Kindle subscription, whatever, it's free. It's really good. It's called When Nashville Bled, The Untold Stories of Serial Killer Paul Dennis Reed. And it's by Judith A. Yates. Oh, it's so good. I read this a while ago. I actually wrote a lot of this and then forgot that I wrote it. But I had to take a lot of detail out because there's so much detail in that book. So I highly recommend it. Whoa, mama, to quote Annie. Annie's been saying that a lot recently. Whoa, mama. It's a good book. Paul Dennis Reed Jr. He was born November 12th, 1957 in Richland Hills, Texas. A lot of his childhood that I found was from his face. So take it with a grain of salt. I don't know how trustworthy he is. If I had to guess, I'm just not going to trust people that kill people. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair.
Yeah, grain of salt. His mom was Josephine Marie. She went by Joni. She moved to Chicago at 16 with her boyfriend, who allegedly forced her into sex work. And eventually she left him and moved to Fort Worth, Texas. And this is where she met Paul's dad, Paul Reed Sr. He was a security officer and a private investigator, and he would also repossess cars for quick cash. So this man was busy.
Mm-hmm.
I did find it interesting. His dad didn't have a car, so when he would repossess cars, he would take the bus.
I mean, look, in his defense, if he's got a key and he's driving his own car, how's he getting his car home?
True. He can reproduce. What? Whoa. Sorry. Obviously he can. Yeah. Paul's here. But He could repossess cars by himself and not have to split the cash because nobody has to drive the other car home.
Yeah, he's just gotta pay the bus driver to get there.
Yeah.
And that's not very expensive.
Yeah, especially if you have a car. So really, his dad was making money.
Okay.
He was also an alcoholic. And he was a jerk. Yeah, he sucked. His dad sucked. Paul Jr. had two older sisters, Linda and Janet. And Paul was said to be developmentally delayed by 5 to 9 months old. And he was born with his left ear malformed, so he had trouble hearing throughout his entire life. His mother and father divorced when Paul was 3, and Linda lived with Joni, and Joni eventually remarried and has 2 more girls. Janet and Paul Jr. went to live with their father. And Paul Sr., he was busy. First of all, he had 3 jobs. He was an alcoholic, so he was always not
in the bottle.
Yeah. So he often left his kids with his mom. And this woman, she was in her 70s. She was a widow. She took care of her mother. She didn't have much money. And Paul Sr., he gave her no money to watch his kids. He was just like, here, mom, gotta go.
She's in her 70s taking care of her mother, who's what, in her 90s at minimum?
Probably around that. It didn't go into it, but like it did say, like, this poor woman.
And then taking care of her grandchildren.
Yes. One of them being very young. Paul was, he was 3 when they got divorced, so he was very young.
This poor woman. Couldn't even be grandma.
Yeah, she couldn't even be the grandma. And Paul, like I said, this started when he was 3. I know that divorce takes a toll on kids. But Paul was just shitty. Like, he was a shitty kid. He was a shitty person. He was shitty. He abused animals. Family members claim he filleted goldfish. And he also beat his grandmother's dog to death with a bat.
Well, sir. She's taking care of you.
Yes. And that's like, that's a brutal way to do it. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're going to do it, that's like, oh, that's, I'm like, nauseous.
That's not like, merciful. That's torture for the dog.
It is sadistic. Yeah. For him. He was also a thief. He stole a purse from a woman at the grocery store when he was 4. He stole clothes off his neighbor's clothesline.
Why?
He deliberately broke things or other kids' things. His or other kids' things. Just destroyed shit. Just stealing, destroying. He constantly terrorized his poor old grandma.
She's taking care of you because your dad isn't.
So some of the things he would do, he would spray her with the water hose, which, like, that feels, that's a kid thing, right?
It'd be just playful, but she's also 70.
That is the most innocent thing on here, and it goes 0 to 100 real quick.
Oh, great.
So he would spray her with the water hose. She was making soup, and when she went to taste it, she noticed that he had put tacks in it. He barricaded her.
That feels counterintuitive because doesn't he have to eat the soup?
Does he have to, or can he just watch everybody else eat it?
Well, I mean, I get that, but that's also his dinner. Maybe I just value food a lot more than I think I do.
I mean, I would value food above him. He's garbage. Even as a kid, he sucks.
Well, I'm not saying over him. I'm just saying, like, in general, don't mess with I'm not messing with my food. Not for any, like, if there's food involved, trust me, you guys are safe. I'm eating it, too. If I'm not eating whatever you're eating, that's the real concern.
If we ever go anywhere together, if we ever meet in person and go anywhere together, if you're not eating it, I'm not eating it.
It's more if it's, like, home cooked. Like, if we go somewhere and I'm like, this Thai food is delicious, and I'm scarfing it down and you're not because you don't like Thai food, that's a you problem, not a me problem.
Oh, no, I love Thai food. Oh, my God.
So my point being, like, is if I or someone is cooking me something, if I'm not eating it, there's a problem. You'll never see me not eating it.
It's gonna be real bad.
Unless it's something I just am like, right now with pregnancy, in my defense, there are some things where I'm like, no, thank you.
No, that's just different. Like, that just wires you different. I don't know what it is, but it's weird. Taxidermy soup. He barricaded her in her bedroom with furniture. And at one point, she woke up to her blankets on fire when he tried to set her on fire as she slept when he was 5.
Oh my God.
Lock him up. Lock him in his bedroom. He was said to have multiple head injuries before adulthood. A kid hit him in the back of the head with a brick at 5. I'm just saying, he probably deserved it. He fractured his skull at 12 when he crashed on a mini bike. And then he had a car accident where he was riding his bike. Somebody hit him head on and his head hit the windshield of this vehicle. And when he was 23 years old, he had another car accident. This one was really bad. And he had a concussion. So this is at least 4 times that he scrambled a little bit up there.
Okay, so he's very scrambled up there.
Mm-hmm. His basically absent father enrolled him in school at the age of 7.
It feels like he should have been in school sooner than that.
Yeah, like I think it's like 4 or 5, depending on when the birthday is. His dad did not enroll him until 7. And even then, he was said to have trouble very early on. There was a school psychologist that said Paul Jr. had a slight learning disorder. And when he was 8 years old, his dad ended up sending him to the Burnett Baylor Boys Home. Good God, Burnett Baylor Boys Home in Houston. And it's a school for troubled youth. But when he was 9, his mom came and got him because the school contacted her wanting to sign forms releasing him into state custody when his dad tried to just disown him.
Like,
put him up. Yeah, he tried to make him a ward of the state. And his mom was like, no. And she brought Paul home with her. According to Paul Sr. According to Paul, get your life together. According to Paul Jr., after this point, he was spoiled. He had it made. He had a great life. I don't believe him, but hey, here we go. He had great Christmases. He participated in 4-H. He raised animals, including rabbits and a horse. He grew crops. He played sports. He was on basketball, baseball, the swim team. He was popular with girls. He was in a special education program in school up until middle school, but this didn't really affect him. When he was 12, he started working at a restaurant that Joni managed in a condominium. Condominium? No, I was right the first time.
A mini condominium. Something. Now I can't say it.
A condominium.
There we go. Jinx.
I love it. Okay.
I said it correctly in my head the first time, and then you said it a different way. And my brain went, we like the different way. We like the other way.
Oh, I kiosked you. I coisted you.
You did coisk me.
Yeah. I'll let you know about it in, God, what, 33 years? At this restaurant, he cleaned tables, he ran ice, he occasionally stole food. He locked the doors to the club and let the teenagers that lived there drink, play pool, and smoke weed. And he eventually helped in the kitchen and behind the bar. You know, typical 12-year-old stuff.
12-year-olds normally help behind the bar.
Yeah, and party with teenagers.
I feel like that's not as unlikely, but
I could see them. I don't even know who they are. I could see teenagers taking advantage of a 12-year-old and being like, mm-hmm. Hey, your mom's a manager. Why don't you let us in? That'd be so cool.
Mm-hmm.
Joni divorced again in 1970 and remarried in 1971. Paul Jr. said he fought with his new stepdad a lot and would leave the house, sometimes for days. But according to court records, at 16 years old, he tried to sexually assault his half-sisters and his mother. And that's when Joni was like, you gotta go. Get out.
Girl, bye.
Mm-hmm. So after this, he went
back. What? Hold on. Time out, though. Because I think that's good on her for protecting herself and her girls.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Granted, I don't know if it was more protecting herself or her girls, but still.
Mm-hmm. I kind of viewed it as, like, possibly she tried. Like, it happened with her. Because it didn't say in what order or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it could be like, okay, that's not acceptable in any way, shape, or form. Like, let's get you help. Let's talk about this. Let's try to get to the bottom of it. And then it didn't stop. And she's like, get out. You got to go. There's no helping you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not putting the rest of my family through this.
Right.
So he went back to Paul Sr. And he lived with him and his other sister until he tried to sexually assault her. And then his dad threw him out.
Okay, so dad's doing the same thing, not having any of it.
Yes. Although I do wonder if it was dad or if it was grandma. So at this point, he dropped out of school. He's living on and off the streets. He's arrested for stealing a car. He gets 3 years probation for that. He's charged with civil assault multiple times, and he's caught forging checks. Part of me is like, okay, 16, 17 years old, somewhere around in there, what more can you do? But also, he sucks. I don't feel bad for him, ever. So he dropped out of school in roughly 1977, sometime around then, is what I saw. So he was 19. I guess if I'd have shut up and read, I would have gotten there. He was arrested that same year for robbing a grocery store, and the charges were dropped when he was ruled legally insane. He was very proud when he got his GED at the age of 20. And then in 1982, a couple years later, he was arrested again for armed robbery in Texas, and he was examined again. And he told psychiatrists that he was a psychiatrist. And he started wearing a piece of fabric tied around his head to protect him from demons.
I don't think that's how that works. I'm pretty sure it's tinfoil for aliens.
What if he soaked the fabric in holy water?
Great question. How did he get a hold of holy water?
I mean, if he was in a mental facility, I'm sure there's... Look, you can call a priest anywhere, right? Like, they can come.
Do they bring enough holy water to soak anything like that? I'm pretty sure it's normally spritzes.
Spritzes. Maybe he just spritzed it. Like, he's just like, here. Maybe he didn't even use the holy water. Maybe he's like, Father, spit on this rag, please.
And maybe that's part of the issue.
That's why the demons got in.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, either way, experts ruled that he was faking insanity. And he was playing the system to avoid jail time. What is wrong with me? He was playing the system to avoid jail time.
What's wrong with you is I made you relive your car experience.
I'm mad all over. My back's spasming. I'm angry and
she's
I'm 80.
So mad that her back just spazzed out. Like, oh my god.
My lower back's been bothering me lately. I don't know what it is. It's probably ulcerative colitis, inflaming random things. That's usually what happens. Mm. But I did find this interesting since he did get at 19 when he got those charges dropped after they said he was legally insane. And the next time he gets in trouble, he turns around and he starts potentially acting insane to try to get out of trouble again.
He learned real quick.
Regardless, the jury found him incompetent to stand trial, and he was sent to a mental hospital, and he was diagnosed with manic type bipolar disorder. Somehow, in this time, he got married. There is a little bit about this in the book. Like, his sisters allegedly told her, like, hey, don't marry him. And she did it anyway. They weren't married long. So she, I'm thinking maybe she didn't know exactly who he was. And then she found out and she was like, I gotta go.
She said, never mind.
Yes. Redacted.
Control Z.
Control Z. I thought it was Control R.
Control Z, undo, right?
Control R is redo.
She doesn't want to redo that. She wants to undo that.
No. Most of the time I delete stuff and I need to. Yeah. Anyway, I don't. Okay. Yes. Delete, delete, delete. Control Z. Set the computer on fire to get rid of him. So he gets married, and then later a jury found him competent. He pled guilty to one count of armed robbery. There were multiple, but he pled guilty to one. And he was sentenced to 20 years in prison. Then his wife divorced him. He serves his sentence in prison, but he's granted parole in 1990. Per the terms of this parole, he has to see a psychiatrist regularly. And this psychiatrist would later go on to say that Paul's mental problems seem to be in remission.
Mm. Okay.
Uh-huh. Around this time, Paul was living off of a workers' comp claim and settlement. So he was a truck driver and he got into a really bad accident. And according to the documentary that I watched, he used this settlement, he used the money from this claim and settlement for plastic surgery. He also got his teeth cleaned up. And then in 1993, he started writing letters to the governor and other representative of Texas. He was upset and he was voicing that, like, you know, we are allowed to do as what, citizens, constituents, we're allowed to do that. They want to hear from us. At least they say they do. He was complaining that the government was watching him and had him under surveillance. And not only did he send these letters to the representatives and the governor, he also made copies of these letters and gave them out to strangers on the street.
So now it's just everyone's involved in this.
Yeah. Which, like, in a way, the government is monitoring. You're on parole, sir. But that's not...
That's neither here nor there, okay?
Yeah. This would later be attributed to his paranoia.
Paranoia.
I swear to God, I'm so country and I hate it. So, I told you he got this plastic surgery. And he had a reason, Bryce. He had a dream. And he was going to make that dream happen. In 1995, he moves to Nashville to follow his dreams of hitting it big in country music.
Oh, God.
And he went by the stage name Justin Parks.
He sucked.
He did. He could not sing. He had no talent. He couldn't entertain. He couldn't sing. He couldn't do none of it. So within a month, he was hired as a cook at a Shoney's.
Man, that must have really hurt his ego.
That's what I'm thinking. And ego was huge to this man. A Saturday night, February 15th in 1997, he went to a Captain D's. And this was not far from the Shoney's that he worked at. And he got an application. He told him he was looking for a part-time job. You know, he cooked at Shoney's. And the next morning on February 16th, he brought the application back, but they weren't open yet. So he knocked on the door and they let him inside. And once inside, he pulled out a .32 caliber pistol. He forced both of the workers into the cooler and had them lay on their stomachs on the floor. The manager, Steve Hampton, he was 25 years old. After forcing him to open the safe, Paul shot him twice in the back of the head and once in the back. Sarah Jackson, she was a part-time employee. She was 16 years old. She was still in high school. She was shot four times on the back of the head and once in the back. A medical examiner would later find two of these to be superficial, and based on a blood pattern left by her gloved hand on a nearby shelf, this indicated she had initially survived and was trying to pull herself up when Paul came in and shot her two more times. After killing both people, he took all the money he could find in the restaurant, including about $250 in coins and $600 from Steve's wallet. He left with roughly $7,000. The bodies were found by police after an employee tried to come into work a little later and couldn't get inside. He tried the front door and he found it weird that it was locked. And when he looked inside, he said the chairs were still up on the table. So he went around to the back door and couldn't get in either. And at this point, he knew something was going on. So he went to a nearby restaurant and called police. Police started investigating, but they really didn't find much. They found shoe prints by the safe. Paul made it a point to take the security tapes with him, so they didn't have those. And he did that in every place.
God, if they try to find him he gets insanity on that. Like, he intentionally took videotapes. He knew what he was doing.
Put a pin in that. They would find Steve's discarded wallet and other items on the side of the road, I believe they said the next day. They were able to get a fingerprint off of his ID and a movie rental card that was found inside the wallet. And for you young kids, you used to have to, you know, like Blockbuster cards and stuff. That's what they're talking about. Now, they would catch a lot of shit for this later because people were upset that Paul's been to prison. They have his fingerprints. But they were unable to find any, they were unable to find any matches or anything. Now,
what year was this again?
It was in the 90s. This was 97. Yeah, it was February 97. APHIS was not created until July of 1999.
That's what I was about to ask, is was that even a thing yet?
So if he would have, and he wasn't in Texas anymore. He was in Tennessee. So if he was still in Texas, maybe, but there was no way. On March 23rd, Paul struck again, this time in Hermitage, Tennessee. I don't think I said that was in Donelson, the Captain D's. I'm sorry. I don't know why I accidentally took that out, but Donelson, Tennessee, this time in Hermitage, Tennessee. And all of these are in Nashville. They're just little neighborhoods in Nashville. This time he went to a McDonald's right after they closed. This McDonald's was about 3.5 miles from the Captain D's. And when the four employees were leaving for the night, Paul approached them with a gun. He forced them back into the restaurant. And once they were in the storeroom, Paul shot 17-year-old Andrea Brown, 27-year-old Ronald Santiago, and 23-year-old Robert A. Sewell.
He does realize that most of them are children.
Yes. And even the ones that aren't, like, everybody's so young. Everybody's so young.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I wonder if he did that on purpose because he's a weak-ass bitch. Now, when he turned his gun to the fourth person, it jammed. And so he was unable to shoot Jose Antonio Ramirez Gonzalez. So he pulled out a knife that he had on him and stabbed him 17 times.
Oh my God, it's so excessive.
Yes. As Jose lay on the floor bleeding out and not moving, Paul cleaned out the registers and ran. And he made it out that night with about $3,000. But when the door closed and it was quiet in the restaurant, Jose crawled to a phone and dialed 911. He had faked being dead to get Paul to leave. First responders arrived and rushed Jose to the hospital. He was treated and he would survive this attack.
Good.
And Paul wasn't done here. On April 23rd, 1997. So these are all about a month apart. April 23rd, 1997. He went to a Baskin-Robbins in Clarksville, Tennessee. Now they had closed for the night, but he somehow convinced them to let him inside. And police were eventually called when one of the girl's brothers came to pick her up at 10:10. And he noticed the store was open, but nobody was inside. Now, this store closed at 10 o'clock. And I've heard about this situation more than once where somebody goes into a restaurant or a store and they're open, but there's nobody there. That I cannot imagine how eerie and just wrong that has to feel being in that situation, especially when your sister's supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
When police arrived, they found that the register and the safe had been emptied. Both girls' purses were still there with the money inside. There was a mop and bucket in the customer area like someone was cleaning, and the freezer door was wide open. But the two employees that were supposed to be working that night were nowhere to be found. And that's because Paul had changed things up this time. He forced 21-year-old daughter and mother, wife, she had a little girl, Angela Holmes, and 16-year-old Michelle Mace into his car and drove them to Dunbar Cave State Park. Their bodies were found the next morning by a man walking his dog near a lake in the park. Both of them were stabbed in the neck. They were found with multiple stab wounds, cuts, and abrasions throughout their bodies. They were believed to have bled to death at the park. A medical examiner would later testify that Angela was found with her arms bound behind her back with a Baskin-Robbins apron. And she died as a result of a stab wound to her neck that went so deep, it went all the way to her backbone.
Oh my hell.
Michelle suffered 14 stab wounds, including a fatal wound to the back of her neck. This medical examiner said that it would have taken between 5 to 15 minutes for them to succumb to their wounds, and they would have been conscious about 80% of that time.
It kind of feels like he decided he liked the feeling of stabbing them more than shooting them.
I think that too, because this happened after he didn't have a choice. With, he had a fucking choice. But this happened after his gun jammed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was a witness that would later testify to hanging out with the victims at the Baskin-Robbins from about 9:20 to when they closed at 10. And this person would say that at some point, a man in his late 20s or early 30s came in and became really obnoxious and was being really loud about the prices before he just left.
He would be that type of person.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, on June 1st, 1997, it was about 9 p.m. on a Sunday night. Paul just shows up on his manager's porch, the manager from Shoney's. It's this 45-year-old Mitch Roberts. And they're just hanging out at home. Mitch's son was actually taking like a home video, like just normal Sunday night. Right.
Yeah, nothing to even think about.
Yeah.
Bat an eye.
Paul had been fired by Mitch back in late February, and it was actually 11 days after the Captain D's murders. So Paul came to his house that night begging for his job back. And Mitch was like, sorry, buddy, no can do. And Paul didn't like this. So as Mitch was walking Paul back to his car, he pulled a gun and some handcuffs out and told Mitch to get in the car. And Mitch, he ran back to the house. Paul followed him, this time with a knife. Mitch fought back and was able to push Paul away, slammed the door in his face, and ran inside. And he yelled at his wife to get the gun. Now, they didn't have a gun. He said this was just his, you know, something he could think of to kind of try to intimidate Paul.
Panicked brain trying to figure anything out.
Yes, and his panic brain worked, because when Paul heard him yell that, he left. He went back to his car, and he drove off. And Mitch called the cops, and as they're at Mitch's house filing a police report, Paul calls Mitch to apologize for what happened.
I just feel like he's trying to build up to another insanity.
I don't know what he's doing at this point. But the officers, they urge Mitch, and he succeeds, into coaxing Paul back to his house, where they arrest the shit out of him. And once he's in custody, he lied about his birthday. So when the police looked into him, nothing came up. He was initially arrested on assault and could be released in just a couple hours. They would have let him go that same night. But Mitch, he was like, no. He pressed police with his belief that Paul was the one responsible for the murders. Because not only did he try to kidnap Mitch with a knife and a gun. He had apparently called in the day of the Captain D's murders, alleging that his car wouldn't start. Mitch smelled a rat, and that rat's name was Paul
Dennis. Mitch has a good nose.
Yeah. Police charged Paul with attempted kidnapping and aggravated assault at Mitch's urging. And this way they can hold him longer, and they start investigating. First thing they do, they call up their buddy Jose, and they're like, hey, we need you to come look at some pictures. And Jose, he looks at 300 different photographs and immediately picks out Paul Dennis Reed from that book as the person who killed his coworkers and tried to kill him. So now they move to this movie card, and they are able to match that. Now that they know who they're looking for, you know, mm-hmm. they're able to match his fingerprint to the one found on the movie rental card and Steve Hampton's driver's license. Which, by the way, this driver's license, it was found on the side of the road about 11 and a half miles away from the Captain D's. It was a little over a mile from Paul's house.
Oh, he's stupid.
He's so dumb. A warrant for his house would later lead them to finding roughly $1,000 in coins. And it was all sorted into 1 gallon jugs, like the big glass wine jugs. And they found multiple pairs of shoes. Now, the threads of these shoes, they didn't match the ones found in front of the safe. But they were the same length, so they were the same size, and there were multiple shoes in this size. And they did find another pair of shoes. It was these white sneakers that had blood on them.
Oh, God.
And this blood would later be found to be human blood, and it matched both women from the Baskin-Robbins. Fibers from his car also matched fibers found on Angela Holmes and Michelle Mace. Witnesses identified Paul as coming into the restaurant the night before to get an application. They identified Paul coming into Captain D's the night before mm-hmm. to get an application. Other people who saw his photo on the news after he got arrested called to tell police that he had been seen around the other crime scenes as well. 3 people claimed to have seen him in the parking lot of the Captain D's the morning of the murders. Paul Reed was charged with 7 murders, as well as some minor charges, and minor in comparison, like robbing, kidnapping, theft. And Paul's family, they fought really hard at trying to prove his mental incompetence.
Throughout. Why?
They believed he was mentally incompetent. Especially his sister, her name's Linda Martiniano. She comes up a lot when you're searching for him. She really fought hard to get them to at least take into account the fact that he had mental problems. But regardless, there was a grand jury hearing, and Jose Gonzalez, he testified that Paul was the man who killed his coworkers and tried to kill him. And after this testimony, the grand jury was like, yeah, we're going to go to trial. And they had 3 separate trials, basically one for each murder scene, one for each crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
The defense claimed that Paul had a broken brain from these head injuries. And he suffered from multiple mental deficits. He had diminished culpability. And the prosecutors, you touched on this earlier, were like, no, 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 no. He planned these. Every single one of these crimes took place when the restaurant was closed. 2 of them he went to before the murders happened, the Captain D's and the Baskin-Robbins. Probably the McDonald's, we just don't know. And he took the security videos and left hardly any evidence. This is he knew what he was doing.
Yeah, he knew exactly what he was doing.
The trials, they resulted in 7 death sentences, 1 each for Steve Hampton, Sarah Jackson, Andrea Brown, Ronald Santiago, Robert Sewell, Michelle Mace, and Angela Holmes. He was also charged with attempted murder for Jose Antonio Ramirez Gonzalez. And seven death sentences, at least at the time, I didn't check, this was the most ever given to any one person in the state of Tennessee.
Good.
Paul Dennis Reed was kept at the Morgan County Correctional Complex in Tennessee. His execution was stayed multiple times, including once in 2003, literally hours before he was scheduled to be executed. And eventually, Paul just waived his right to appeal. He's like, I'm done. And his family, along with activists against the death penalty, claimed he was not mentally capable to make that decision.
He was mentally capable of killing seven different people and severely injuring at least one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But at least this, no, they fought this too. They fought a lot. I don't know. I'm torn because I don't know what I would do in this situation if it were my brother, but also like he killed a bunch of people horrendously.
Look,
and he enjoyed it. You can't tell me he didn't enjoy it.
But that's why I think he went to the knife is because he enjoyed it mm-hmm. more. He liked it made it more personal for him.
He was constantly escalating because he went from robbing to robbing and murdering to robbing, kidnapping and murdering to, I mean, that's what he was doing the night he left too. He had the gun and the handcuffs, then he came back with the knife. Like, he wasn't going to stop, and he knew what he was doing, and he liked it. That's me. Welcome to my TED Talk. They filed multiple motions to stay his execution. Some of these were successful, and some of them weren't. And Linda, his sister, she fought this hard. And to her credit...
Is she one of the sisters that he attempted to sexually assault?
Or... I tried to find that. I don't know. I could not tell. I tried to find that out myself. Because it kind of makes you wonder. Like, I don't know if I would give her more credit or what. I don't know. Oh, to her credit, Paul was acting weird. He was doing some strange stuff. He would randomly fight against verdicts. And then he would appeal some, but not others. He fought against the death penalty and then later just professed his will to die. He was paranoid. He claimed to be part of a government mind control project called Scientific Technology, and they monitored his every move. Sir, you're in prison. They do that. And he called his lawyers actors.
Yeah, they act like they like you. They act like they want to help you.
Yeah. Now, the prosecution, they claimed this was all a ploy. They said Paul was a con artist and faking his delusions as a defense mechanism and to try to get out of this crime, just like he's done before. His execution date was stayed again in 2000 by the U.S. District Judge Todd J. Campbell, and this was pending investigation of the constitutionality of Tennessee's lethal injection methods. But they continued appealing stays of executions in 2008. So he kind of got a little break that year. Paul Dennis Reed Jr., also known as the fast food killer, he eventually died after spending 2 weeks in the Nashville General Hospital. He died November 1st, 2013, at 55 years old, from complications due to pneumonia, heart failure, and upper respiratory issues.
That's not okay.
Yeah, and that's the that on that.
I have heard this story. I just couldn't remember details because it's been so long. I still don't like him.
No.
Like I said, these are all kids.
Yeah. Literal babies. Every single one of them. Excuse me. I think the oldest...
was 27.
Yeah. Which was the manager of the McDonald's. I think it was Ronaldo. I didn't write it down, sorry. Ronald Santiago. I don't know why I keep wanting to call him Ronaldo, because I suck. Okay. Sorry.
He just sucks.
Yeah.
Is that, so this picture of the very top one that's labeled with just numbers, is that Ronald?
Hey, yeah. Yes, sorry. I thought I changed that one.
I think it was, but something happened and it changed.
Okay, so it wasn't just me, because I could have sworn I changed that.
Yeah, because Angela was the first one, and then a couple minutes ago, it changed back.
Okay. Weird, but yes, I fixed that.
You have way too many pictures of this dude on here. Nobody likes Paul Dennis Reed.
I couldn't decide which one to keep. I think I'm going to get rid of this one because he looks dumb in all of them.
He does. I can't figure out what he paid for this plastic surgery, though. Because he doesn't look good.
No. I know they did mention his teeth specifically. Like, I think they said he lined them up or got them realigned. I don't know what you do with teeth.
He got some braces, some veneers.
Oh, in the 90s?
So he's got something.
But this little, I don't think it's a headshot. It's like a professional photo of him
trying to play holding guitar.
Yeah, like this is the lengths he went to. He was dead set on becoming a country music star.
He's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk about something that's not ridiculous? Actually, it is pretty ridiculous, but
let's go. Ooh. Ooh.
Do you know this one just based off of pictures?
I don't know, but just based off of pictures, I know that it's a paranormal. God, I'm smart.
Yes, you are correct. It is a paranormal.
I know that it's a possession.
No.
Oh.
It is not a possession. Look, okay, so I'm not meaning to point out where we're slacking. I just keep finding where we're slacking, okay?
Okay.
Because I found another topic we haven't covered in ages. The last topic labeled with this is episode 26.
Get out.
Yes. Because we're going to be talking about a poltergeist today.
Oh, boy.
Now, I know I just said the last poltergeist case was 26, but there might have been a couple other cases that touched on poltergeist. We just don't have them labeled as poltergeist, or they weren't poltergeist-centric. And so, from what I could find, the last one we had listed as specifically a poltergeist case was episode 26, which was the Bell Witch.
Ugh. Okay. Is this as good as the Bell Witch?
No, I don't know that any poltergeist... This is probably why we stopped at the Bell Witch, is because the Bell Witch is... She's queen, okay?
Yeah.
She is queen poltergeist. But we are going to be talking about the Doris Bither... I've heard it pronounced a couple ways, and you'll hear some people say Blither, Bither, or Bither. I'll probably say Bither or Bither, depending on my mood, okay?
Okay.
But we are talking about the Doris Bither case today. This is also known as the Entity Haunting. Okay. Now, a lot of information about Doris Bither's background is unknown. We don't know when she was born. We know she was born in the U.S. Some places state she was born in the Midwest and moved to California before she was even a teen. Some say she moved from Illinois to California when she was a teen. There's a lot of conflict about her background. Some say that she had a brother, unclear if it's older or younger. Her parents were alcoholics. There were also claims that from a young age, she would begin to play with Ouija boards and participating in seances. And according to her son, due to his mother's rambunctious ways, she was disowned as a teen. So her parents were like, goodbye, have fun, Doris. And then also, the claims are that she struggled with alcoholism and drug use in her younger days as well. So,
which sounds like that's all she knew.
Yeah. However, again, it's unclear. We don't know the full extent. And I will be honest, I did not read the book that her son released about her, mostly because I couldn't find it. Mm-hmm. But also, it's not her telling the story. So it's just, there's a lot of, keep in mind with all of our paranormals, it's always reportedly. This one, there's a lot of, this was said and this was said, but it's not clear if these are accurate.
Gotcha. Okay.
So, Doris Bither and her four children, they're living in a home in California. The youngest of her children I had was 6, and the oldest was 16. One girl, 3 boys, and the youngest was the girl. Now, again, like I said, there's a lot of, this was said, he said, she said, okay? The sources state the home they were living in, they were living in it illegally, and they claim that it was also a condemned home. So not in great shape, barely hanging on by a thread type of thing. she also claimed that when she moved into the home, an unknown woman would tell her that they needed to leave, specifically because the house was evil, there were evil spirits, and then that lady would just leave, like, never to be seen again.
Oh, okay.
I feel like if someone knocked on my door of the new house and told me that, I'd be like, okay, stop unpacking, let's go.
Yeah. Better yet, well, that backpack, leave it there. We don't need it.
It's got bad mojo on it now. Leave it.
Yeah.
So, she claims that after moving in, that this woman shows up, tells them, don't stay here. And then just months later, attacks would begin. We'll talk about the attacks here in a few minutes. Reports also suggest, like I said, Taurus, her parents are said to be alcoholics. But the reports also suggest that Doris had a history of physical and substance abuse and sexual abuse, as well as childhood trauma. So it's not clear what that was, but the reports are like, she kind of had a crap life. Like, from her parents to her lovers and husbands, ex-husbands, all of that kind of had a rough life. Now, at the time of the story, she is reportedly in her 30s, but we don't have full clarity on what her actual age is. And reports state she actually never gave investigators her age. She just refused. Was like, okay, no, I'm in my 30s.
Mind your business, guys.
Gosh, guys, it's not very polite to ask a woman how old she is. Just literally, like, you can't ask her weight.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. There are also reports that Doris had tough relationships with her three boys, the three oldest. Most stated that this was like a tense relationship, and the boys appeared to be moody or troubled. Some claim that the oldest harbored dark and resentful feelings towards Doris, but I couldn't get clarity on where they got this from. Some claims also stated that the boys would often roughhouse in front of investigators. However, I don't know the extent of the roughhousing, but I feel like roughhousing among siblings can be pretty normal.
Yeah.
So, okay. I'm not sure. Again, take it with a grain of salt. So, just right off the bat, a lot of people, as she starts telling her story, they are like, Doris, you've had a troubled past. You're having issues with your children. You're drinking. You're an alcoholic. You're a drug user. You're in this condemned home illegally. Like, your story's probably exaggerated, right? But in 1974, Doris would contact a parapsychologist, Barry Taff. Barry was working in a parapsychology lab that was run by Thelma Moss at the University of California. But she would contact him, and she would report to Barry she had some alarming experiences, and she would report manifestations such as luminous, which from what I could tell was just another way of saying orbs.
Okay.
Transparent human shapes, things falling from shelves on their own, strange lights banging on the walls, lights flickering, bumping into unseen entities. Doris claimed to have been thrown against a wall by an unseen and unknown force. The kids also claimed being bitten, scratched, pushed. At least one child claimed to be thrown into a wall by an unseen force. One child also attempted to protect their mother from the entity and would end up with a broken arm, according to some reports.
Oh my god.
And the more serious of claims, which those are pretty serious, but the more serious of claims was that Doris Bitherbyther had been attacked and raped by 1 to 3 invisible entities. Some call them invisible entities. Some say partially visible.
Okay.
She would claim that these entities were specifically Asian. Two of them would hold her down. The two smaller ones would hold her down, and the third one that was larger would then rape her. She would claim it also left bruising on her inner thighs. Specifically on her inner thighs was mentioned the most, but it did talk about on her ankles and on her arms, as well as on her breasts.
Oh, okay.
So, not great things happening. One of her children would claim to have seen a ghost they also called Mr. Who's It. This is the one they believe that was biting, scratching, pushing the kids. So, like, 4 different entities.
That's terrifying, like, that name. I don't even know why, but in that situation, oh my god, what a horrible name.
Yeah, I didn't really enjoy that, but I'm just telling you what happened.
That's damn creepy. Yeah.
Now, the story about her actually reporting this to Barry and starting to get him his help was that Doris overheard Barry Taff and his colleague, Carrie Gaynor, in a bookstore talking about ghosts. Now, there are some versions that they're in a bookstore talking about ghosts. Some are that they're giving a lecture talking about ghosts and paranormal things. Again, you'll always see those conflicting reports.
Okay.
But they claim that she would approach them, tell her about some of the occurrences, and that would spark their intrigue. Now, some do claim it wasn't Doris, but a friend of hers that Doris had told about all these things. She's the one that approached them and was like, please help my friend Doris. So the story is that somebody overheard Barry Taff and Carrie Gaynor in a bookstore or somewhere near a bookstore. And they were like, please help. And they were like, sure. Now, Barry, with the assistance of Carrie Gaynor, they would go out and visit the Culver City house for the very first time on August 22nd, 1974. So they are, in fact, following up on her claims. Now, from what I could find, Barry Taft's main reason for going was due to the allegations of violence and the fact that the children had seen and experienced things. It wasn't necessarily about the sexual assault, the spectral sexual assault allegations. He didn't necessarily believe those were true. But they were following up because of just the violence aspect of it.
Okay.
So Barry and Carrie, they visit the home over the course of 10 weeks. And they claim that they came in with a skeptical mind, but that would change when they said that they had seen a metal skillet come out of a cupboard in the kitchen, blew across the room, and landed, you know, wherever. They don't know how. There were no earthquakes or anything reported in the area. And some sources stated that they observed its movement as it, like, curved. So it's not like it went in a straight line. It's like it curved.
Oh.
And they said it traveled about 2.5-ish feet from what I could find. So that's kind of where they're like, huh, there might be some truth behind these claims.
They got there and the entity was like, I'm calling your bluff.
They're like, oh, you're not afraid of me? Watch this.
Yeah.
Now, over the course of the 10 weeks, Barry and Carrie would note that they considered, or what they considered, poltergeisty activity, which did include objects appearing to fall from shelves on their own, strange lights, and odors cold zones, as well as some manifestations and apparitions. Though, through the course of their research and investigation, they would note that all of these occurrences would begin to decrease over the course of time. So, like, it was really active at the beginning, but towards the end, they're like, now it's not.
Huh. Okay. This is towards the end of the 10 weeks.
Yeah, that's what they stated after their investigation. That would have been after the 10 weeks was up.
Huh. Okay.
Now, during the course of the investigation, many additions to the research team or investigation team would come and go. At least one of Doris Bither's friends claimed to be a medium. I mean, she didn't use the word medium. I just was able to communicate with spirits. She would come in, help. Colleagues from the research lab with Barry and Carrie would come in and help. Other people that they were familiar with would come in with the investigation, which did include photographers. Now, during the course of the investigation, many claim to not experience anything, but others claim they did. So it's really a big mix of what people experienced. For the most part, what I could find is that the super bizarre claims that they had, like the really crazy out there items that Barry and Carrie had seen, the claim is that they only saw that between Barry, Carrie, and Doris. There might be some poltergeisty activity when other people are there, but they're not this outlandish, like, oh, this happened. It was like, oh, there was an orb. Okay, that's it. You know?
Okay, yeah.
Now, they start experimenting, and they have to learn how to provoke the entities. So they learn of a few ways, including Doris in some way being able to summon them. From what I could find, normally she would just kind of antagonize them, curse, yell at them, that type of stuff, and they would
figure.
Go up.
Yeah.
But also in general, the entities seemed very attracted to Doris. They were more active when she was around, and they were even more active if she was drinking or drunk. Also another so, way.
Kind of sounds like they're using her as bait.
Mm-hmm.
I hate it. Okay.
Another way they found that they were able to get these entities around was by playing Black Sabbath and Uriah Heep. According to her oldest son, it was the key was to play songs about the devil that really got those ghosties wound up.
Okay.
So
they just want to rock.
Either that or they're like, someone said the devil, we're here.
You rang.
So in one instance, they claimed that Barry, Carrie, and Doris stood in Doris's bedroom and told, they were like, Doris, go ahead and summon these ghosts. She starts cursing them out and all that stuff. And they claimed that they saw lights popping up in the room. And soon after, they would see a green mist that would form the shape of a man. Now, some said it was only the upper half and there were no distinct facial features. And they would snap a picture, and in the picture, it would show an orb that appears to arc over Doris in her head. That's the picture that you saw.
The picture here. Okay. Yeah.
And that's actually one of their more, like, for Barry and Carrie, that's their most, like, oh my gosh, here's our biggest piece of evidence that we have that proves that this is happening.
That is a wild picture.
It is. It is. And keep in mind, some reports said that these are, like, Polaroid, like snap and then shake it like your picture, you know?
Huh.
So that's one thing. Another claim is that they would stand in the room and Doris would tell them. Now, some said it was Doris. Others said this was Doris's friend that was like the medium. But they would tell them, the investigation team, where the entity was. And again, keep in mind, they're using Polaroid cameras. And when they would snap a picture of where Doris or her friend pointed out that the entity was, in many of the pictures, they would come out with either large white fuzzy spots, orbs, or just all white in some cases.
So they wouldn't come out at all.
Yeah. But the weird thing that they state is that when they would tell them that, okay, the entities are gone, they would take a picture with the same camera where they had previously taken the picture, and it would come out normally.
Ugh, I just got the heebie-jeebies.
Now, there is a claim that they did not do this the same day or with the same camera, so that could be unclear. I understood most of the claims as same day, same camera. Entity's gone, they take a picture of the corner again, and it's fine.
It's gross. Yes. I don't know what else to say. It's gross.
Yeah, it's not my favorite either. Now, speaking of orbs, there were also many claims that people witnessed orbs, not just in... like, not just on the wall, because a lot of times the claim stated that it was, like, a light on the wall, like, maybe a flashlight or something like that in the look, because they did try to debunk it. Uh-huh. But they kind of talked about how the orbs were able to change their motion, change their size, their intensity. Some claimed that they could come off of the wall. I took this as it's coming off of the wall to essentially become, like, a three-dimensional orb.
Yeah.
So it's, like, on the wall, 2D. And then comes off and is now 3D. Which I didn't like. They claim to have tried to document and photograph the orbs, but with no success. There is another occasion a group of investigators would be in the bedroom attempting to make contact with the entities. And Carrie would claim to have heard whispering that repeated, kiss me, kill me. I don't know how many times it repeated that, but it did enough that he was like, what the hell? And that happens just before a large and heavy flower pot would crash in the center of the group. The flower pot reportedly had been sitting across the room and just narrowly missed the heads of some of the assembled investigators.
Why is it always flower pots? Like, I feel like this is creepy, but that just adds a layer of comedy to it, and I don't like it.
I don't know why it's flower pots, but I guess it is. What the hell is his name? Because I have it spelled wrong. Barry Taff. Excuse me. Barry Taff, he would ultimately conclude that there was some sort of paranormal phenomena involved. For the most part, most articles said that Barry dismissed the spectral sexual assault. He was like, that's not happening. But there is something paranormal going on. Years after the investigation, people who reviewed the case, they've come out speak against the findings. I mentioned earlier that her son had... spoke about her being disowned, but middle son, so same son, Brian Harris, would speak out and talk of his mother a lot more. He actually spoke a lot, quite a bit, to Javier Ortega in 2011. And he specifically, he talked about the way that his mother was painted was inaccurate. He was like, my mother was not a drunk. She might have drank on occasion, but not to the point that Barry Taffy would paint her. And yeah. He really just came in, just swinging, defending his mom and stating that her claims were true and that she herself was not causing the claims, because a lot of what was stated was it was basically the power of her mind that was causing the poltergeist to be there. Like, it was like her demons that she was manifesting.
Oh, so he was basically blaming it on the mother.
Yes.
And the son was like, no, you're not going to talk about my mom like that.
Yeah. Okay. Now, some claim that, I believe it was this son, I haven't noted as a son, he also was an alcoholic and a drug addict. The other two sons, though, would come out and they're like, okay, these are the things that are accurate and these are the things that are not. But they're just like, this is really kind of crazy. Like, the three boys did absolutely say, yes, this was happening. And so they just kind of talk about it in interviews. And then claims would also come out that the home had, in fact, never been condemned. Some claim that only Barry Taff would make those claims. He's the only one that said it had been condemned.
And I don't know how I feel about this Larry Taff guy.
Fellow. Barry Taff?
Barry.
Yeah. Many claim that Taff was using the findings he had to fit his conclusion rather than allowing the findings to guide him to a conclusion. So he's not using the scientific method at all. And 4 decades after the investigation, Benjamin Radford would state that the case likely included a distressed family, poor investigation techniques, and confirmation bias. So, like, he's basically saying, like, they didn't do a great job investigating, as well as Taff already had an opinion made up before even coming in and investigating. He was just making it work, like the evidence worked for him.
Yeah.
And so this case, it's very crazy. Okay. It's like, there's still a lot of unknown, right? Eventually Doris, she gives up the fight with the house in Culver City and moved to Carson. But she would claim the ghosts were not attached to the house, at least not anymore, because she claimed they followed her to Carson. Okay. So a lot of people talk about what could have been happening. Some people believe that there was some discourse or a lot of discourse between her and her three sons, and that her stress, drinking, trauma, whatever it was, they basically are saying that she's like a psychic of some sort. I can't remember the correct word that they used. Because of course I didn't write it down. I put psychic, but she was sensitive to spirits, and basically either her drinking, her stress, whatever it was her causing this. And the three spirits were like her demons with her sons.
Oh, okay.
So there's that one. Others believe
this
that, well,
poor woman just wanted help. And they're like, this is all your fault. And your sons are making it worse.
Yeah. Others claim that it could have been demons that she had attached to her from her days playing with the Ouija board or doing seances. Most of the articles stated they were dark seances.
Mm-hmm.
Some just said it was she drank so much, like she was sensitive to spirits, but she drank so much to kind of blur that out. It gave them power. There was a lot of theories behind it, and you'll find a ton more theories about it. Those are the most popular ones.
This is just like one after the other. This is your fault. This is your fault. This is your
really
fault.
A lot of people blame, like,
victim blaming as hell.
Yeah. And a lot of people thought, like, her drug use and her past and her trauma and her being a sensitive to spirits just kind of all caused her unintentionally to basically create these with the power of her mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what a lot of people believe. Now, Doris, she would pass away at the age of somewhere around 58 in 1999, according to most sources. Most sources state that her son is the one that gave the age and date. And this case would actually become the inspiration for the book and the movie, The Entity, which was released. The movie was released in 1982. But that is the poltergeist. I know it's pretty short, but there's a lot of, and then they said this, and they said this, and he and she.
Yeah.
Now, I will say, if you listen to some podcasts, there's a lot of bias against Barry Taff. I did not do a lot of reading on Barry Taff. I did read a couple of his articles, but I mean, I just tried to take the things that he said happened, not necessarily anything else, but a lot of people seem to be very against Barry Taff. And a lot of that is because even to my knowledge, he's still alive. And to this day, he is using this case to earn money because he can. So some people.
Kind of sounds like a dude who had a cootie queen.
Yeah. Again, I didn't do a lot of reading on him. I did see one on one article or that mentioned his LinkedIn profile, and I couldn't even bring myself to put in what he has in there. But he really thinks a lot of himself.
Oh.
So let's just put that out there. This isn't to say he's good or bad at what he does. I'm just saying he really thinks a lot of himself.
He kind of sounds like he would. Like, just from what you told me in the story, I don't think I care for him too much.
Yeah. Yeah. So, again, they didn't get a lot of evidence. There was even something, a video evidence that never came out that they claimed they had, or they attempted to get, and it just didn't work. So, there's just a lot of, well, we tried this, and it didn't work, and we tried this, and it didn't work, but we all saw this with our own eyes.
Yeah.
So, definitely a lot going on with this case. Obviously, it's still unclear, and even to today, like, you can't really do a lot of investigation. Doris has since passed away. And so, basically, everything you hear is secondhand. Even, like, her past her childhood, you hear it from her children. You don't hear it from her.
Yeah.
So, there's a lot of, there's still a lot of questions and unknowns for that case.
Yeah, like you said, she doesn't even have the chance to defend herself.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, I don't know, I believe her.
You know what? I believe her only because, for some reason, I don't like Barry Taff. And Barry, it's not you. Actually, Barry, it's not me, it's you.
I had to fight myself from being like, no, it's you. It's yeah, absolutely you.
It's you.
You kind of sound like a jerk.
You kind of sound like you heard her claims and were like, well, I know what it is already. Just because a lot of people say that he really inflated her mental state and her drug use and her alcoholism. He really made that look way worse than what it was.
For his own benefit.
Yes.
Basically.
Now, again, I don't know how true it is. I don't know how true it is. I'm just saying if her children are coming out and saying that's not true, then I'm more inclined to believe her children. But yeah. Also, maybe she hid it really well from her children. Or maybe that's all her children knew and they don't know what their mom looked like sober, so they thought she was. I don't know.
I feel like, though, like, hiding that from four, if, like, some of the kids were like, no, that's straight up truth. And other, you know, like maybe two or three of them were like, no, that's not true at all. I would be more likely to believe him. But if all four kids are like, absolutely not, our mom was not like that, then.
I didn't see anywhere where the daughter ever spoke out, but the three sons did. And it's not that they denied that she hadn't had a history with alcoholism and drug use. It's just that they claimed she was clean at that point.
Okay.
So.
Still, that just leads me to believe him even more. Like, they're not, like you said, they're not denying it. They're just like, hey, that's part of her past. It's who she is, but it's not who she was at this time.
Right. So it was an interesting case to read about. Like I said, if you listen to some podcasts, you will hear a lot of bias against Barry Taff. I did start listening to one, but I stopped because of how much biased it seemed to be against Barry Taff. And I opted to read his articles to form my own opinion. And I was like, you're kind of annoying.
Oh, this podcast is making sense now.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's why I don't like him, is because I'm like, eh, you're annoying. Like, please stop talking.
I like that one, though. Like, I'm still looking at this picture. That's a very strange picture.
It is.
I don't know anything at all about developing photos, but I know that looks creepy.
It does look creepy. And obviously you have the people that are like, well, that was developed wrong, or something happened during development, or it's a scratch, or things like that. And it's like, it doesn't look like a scratch on the picture.
It does. That's what I was thinking. Like, that was a scratch. And like I said, me and my photo ignorance, that's creepy.
Right. All we know is what we see, and that's creepy.
Yeah. And I see a barrier around that woman.
Uh-huh. Which definitely is weird, because it almost looks like a halo to me.
Yeah.
So I'm like, why would there be a halo if they're attacking her? But it could have been like the movement of an orb with the exposure of the camera.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a lot of things it could have been. It also could have been a bug, with the movement of the bug, reflection from the light, and exposure of the camera. You know, there's a lot of things it could have been.
Because is that camera in his hand, this dude man on the left over here? I was going to say in plaid, but there's also a girl in plaid.
Let me look, because I don't remember. I don't remember the entire picture.
It's like,
yeah. Yeah, it is.
So it looks like maybe he could have a flash on, and it was something with the two cameras taking a picture at the right time.
That's still a weird way for that to develop.
Yeah, it is.
So, I did also, the picture of the house that's in there, that's the actual house. The current owner's residents say there's nothing going on in there, so.
That house doesn't look dilapidated or what? Is that like a recent photo, though?
Yeah, I think that one's a recent one. I couldn't find like an old one.
Yeah. Which is another thing, too. Like, if the house was as bad as you say it was, why didn't you take a picture of it?
Right. But also, again, the only claims that you'll hear, I mean, obviously, you have a lot of articles that are going off of what Barry Taff said. Mm-hmm. But there are people that have done deep dives that are like, this house has never been condemned, and Barry Taff said it had been condemned twice.
Oh.
And so you have people that are skeptical of things that Barry Taff says. Now, I don't know how to see if a house has ever been condemned. I'll just straight up say it. I'm sure I could Google it. I'm not going to.
Yeah, I'm going to guess there's some kind of city records or whatever.
Yeah, I'm sure. But again, I mean, I'm just telling you, this house doesn't look like it's dilapidated. Like, yeah, it's a small house, but that doesn't mean anything. Yeah. And it could have been unkempt maybe in the front yard, but that doesn't mean that it's unlivable.
Yeah, that's a big difference.
Yeah, so. Also, especially if she's dealing with a poltergeist. And I didn't mention this, but there were reports that stated she was being sexually assaulted every night. Like, it was a frequent thing.
Oh my God.
If you're stressed and that's happening to you, your house, like your front yard, might become unkempt. Like, I don't do my yard work. Cody does it. That's why I got little Miss Grinch Paws back there hiding somewhere. You know? But anyways, that's my story.
I liked that one. Even if it was a little short one, I liked it a lot.
Yeah, I knew it would be short, but I also was like, paranormals typically are short.
Yeah.
We're also pretty quiet. You were very invested.
I was. I was staring at this picture for a hot minute. Because I was trying to, like, pick out, like, maybe there's a shadow.
No. Nothing. Nope. Well, thank you all for listening to Helen Heels Podcast. To see pictures from this episode, you can follow us on Instagram, Helen Heels Podcast, X Helen Heels Pod, or Facebook, Helen Heels Podcast. You can find us on Linktree by typing in Helen Heels Podcast. If you want to support us, please like, review, rate, share, and subscribe on your preferred listening platform. If you want to take your support one step further so we can create more content for you, you can donate through Patreon. We're working to release specials for our patrons. If you have your own true crime or paranormal story, suggestions, or words of encouragement, please email us at helenheelspodcast@gmail.com. Thank you all so much for listening. Be sure to tell your friends to listen with you as well. Bye.
Bye.